The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Made possible by the support of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
Citizen Soldier, 150 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, featuring Pulitzer Prize-winning author James McPherson, and from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, James Cornelius. Coming up next. Welcome to the Pritzker Military Library Citizen Soldier, produced in partnership with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. I'm Ken Clark. The Emancipation Proclamation is one of the most famous documents in American history.
The Emancipation Proclamation was issued by President Lincoln under his authority as Commander-in-Chief on January 1, 1863. It was a military order, not binding legislation, which proclaimed all slaves in the areas of the Confederacy at war with the United States to be free. Though slavery was not legally outlawed until the adoption of the 13th Amendment in 1865, the Emancipation Proclamation was an important stepping stone toward freedom, serving as both a military necessity toward Union victory and as an impassioned act of justice.
Today, I have the privilege of being joined by two scholars on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. James Cornelius is curator of the Lincoln Collection at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. He is author of many books, articles, book reviews on various topics, including American and British history. James M. McPherson is the George Henry Davis Professor Emeritus of United States History at Princeton University. The Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Battle Cry of Freedom, Professor McPherson is regarded as one of the country's leading Civil War scholars. Welcome, gentlemen. So, let's talk a little bit about the summer of 1862, disillusionment with the conciliatory approach to the problem of the South.
Well, at the beginning of the war, Lincoln and many other Northerners assumed that Southern whites had been swept into secession by the passions of the moment back in the crisis winter of 1860-1861, but at heart, many of them were still patriotic Unionists, patriotic Americans. And the idea here was that if you could defeat Confederate armies, but at the same time conciliate the Southern population, promise to protect their property, promise not to move against slavery, you would eventually be able to woo them back into the Union. And for a while, that seemed to be a potentially promising avenue. And then during the first half of 1862, Union armies won a series of really important victories along the South Atlantic coast, in the interior, the rivers of the South Midwest, that looked like it was going. They occupied a very large amount of Confederate territory, and it looked like they were on the verge of winning the war. And as a consequence, there didn't seem to be the necessity to strike against slavery that I mentioned a moment ago. But then the war reversed momentum in the summer of 1862. Robert E. Lee became commander of the Army of Northern Virginia and carried out a counteroffensive in the 7 days that rocked Union forces back on their heels. Stonewall Jackson won a series of victories in the Shenandoah Valley. Confederate armies in the Western Theater picked themselves up off the floor and even invaded Kentucky in August and September of 1862. So the war suddenly was going badly for the North. And as a consequence, Lincoln began to think seriously about striking against slavery as a way of weakening the Confederacy and strengthening the North.
And that wasn't necessarily what his party had ever promised. The platform under which the Republicans were elected in the fall of 1860 did state that they would not interfere with slavery in those states where it was legal. And Lincoln felt strongly about that, that as party leader, he shouldn't be the one upsetting the party platform.
It's interesting because you're talking about outside forces, public opinion, the will of Congress, the need to avoid foreign intervention.
Well, public opinion is a fickle instrument, and it's often difficult to interpret. And Lincoln had to take that into consideration. Public opinion on the question of slavery ranged all the way from what we might call the left, the abolitionists and the radical Republicans, to the right, the Democrats and especially the Peace Democrats, and the border state unionists, those slaveholders in states like Kentucky and Missouri and Maryland who would remain loyal to the Union, but might quickly go over to the other side if any sudden movements were made against slavery. And Lincoln also had to take into consideration foreign opinion. But if it became clear, as Lincoln said on more than one occasion, that the North was fighting for freedom while the Confederacy was fighting for slavery, that could have a very significant impact on foreign public opinion. So that also entered into the mix of motives and considerations about whether to proceed toward emancipation.
He wasn't always perceived as a shining figure. The next image that we have is a slightly different view of Lincoln and his role in the American.
That's right. You saw there his the pen, the quill pen, in Lincoln's hand, making him the author, sort of the hero of the moment, the great emancipator, as he was called at times. Here's the other end of the ideological spectrum. This is a cartoon by a German dentist in Baltimore named Adalbert Volk, who loathed Lincoln, who loathed the idea of emancipation. What you see is Lincoln's foot on top of the Constitution on the floor. You see him dipping his pen into an inkwell held by the devil. You see bats flying around in outside one of the windows, and you see an uprising of freed slaves causing riot. Baltimore is about 40 miles from Washington. Lincoln knew that. It was not Union territory, and in general, Lincoln was surrounded by people who did not favor this move, and yet, for military reasons and others, he made it.
The idea of the Confederates using slave labor as part of the military effort, or the teeth in the tail, as it's been termed, a logistical force. The image that we have on the screens now kind of gets into a little bit about slaves as contraband. And James, if you can talk about the image and then lead into the teeth in the tail part of the Confederate effort.
Yes, it was really an ingenious turning of the tables by General Butler to take the very Southern definition of human beings as property and to call them property then and therefore not returnable as contraband of war, ingenious and effective. And so here we see such a moment in which a Union company has arrived at a place with a good many African Americans living, evidently family members all in one there, welcoming the Union soldiers. Word had got around pretty early in the war that if Union soldiers were coming near you, that you might be freed by them. No one really knew what the legal situation might be from one place to the next. But this is an example of hope that this contraband of war idea, which it came to be called a little later, would bear fruit and lead to real and legal emancipation.
Well, Benjamin Butler was a major general in command of Union forces at Fortress Monroe on the Virginia Peninsula near Hampton Roads. And in May of 1861, when the war was only a month old, three slaves had escaped from the Confederate side of Hampton Roads, where they'd been working on Confederate fortifications, and came into Butler's lines and asked for asylum. And Butler interviewed them, found out that they had been working on Confederate fortifications, and declared them contraband of war and therefore liable to seizure under the laws of war, where you can seize enemy property that's being used to wage war against the United States. And since in Southern law slaves were considered to be property, Butler proceeded to confiscate them. And when a Confederate major came across under flag of truce the next day to ask for them to be returned under the Fugitive Slave Act, Fugitive Slave Law, Butler said, no, these are contraband of war. You are waging war against us, and you are using black labor for that purpose, and therefore they are liable to seizure. That phrase, contraband of war, became the opening wedge that have led eventually to the Emancipation Proclamation, which was issued under the same idea that Lincoln, now as Commander-in-Chief of the United States Army and Navy in time of war, had the power to confiscate enemy property being used to wage war against the United States, in this case slaves, and that's really what the Emancipation Proclamation was.
So, Jim, the teeth and the tail.
Well, in military terminology, the teeth of an army are its combat troops in the front lines. The tail of an army is the logistical apparatus that supports them, the supply network, the cooks, the commissary, everything that goes into making an army possible to function, to move. And in the case of the Confederate Army, a substantial part of that tail, that logistical network, were slaves. They served as teamsters, they served as blacksmiths, they were cooks, they were hospital attendants, they were officers' servants, they were laborers who were forced to build fortifications, to dig trenches, to drive the supply wagons. Without that slave labor, the Confederate armies could not have functioned. And what that meant was that in the Union Army, a substantial part of that tail, that logistical infrastructure that supported the army, had to be troops that otherwise could not serve as teeth. In the Confederate Army, if you had slaves to constitute a substantial part of the tail of the army, that released the white troops to be part of the teeth of the army. And it made it possible for the much smaller white population of the Confederacy to constitute a much larger percentage of the combat troops of their army than it was for white soldiers from the North.
I think this is a great time to go into the idea of the Emancipation Proclamation as an act of justice. Jim, if you can talk some about the anti-slavery movement within the Republican movement at the time, and where Lincoln was at the beginning of the war and where he kind of ended up.
Well, from the very beginning of the Republic, there were large elements of the population that considered slavery wrong, immoral, unjust, contrary to the golden rule and the preachings of Jesus. And by the 1830s, that had evolved into a pretty militant abolitionist movement, which persuaded only a very small minority of the Northern people initially of its proposal for the immediate abolition of slavery and the conversion of the slaves into free citizens of the United States. But as time went on, and as the Southern response to this abolitionist movement was to defend slavery as what they called a positive good, you had an increasing polarization between a broader anti-slavery movement that took root in the North and an increasingly aggressive and militant pro-slavery argument that became more powerful in the South. And by the 1850s, this bifurcation, this polarization, had come into politics in a major way. With the founding of the Republican Party in 1854, which was really an outgrowth of this anti-slavery movement. And its first presidential election in 1856, when the Republican platform branded slavery as a relic of barbarism. And the Republican Party pledged to restrict the further expansion of slavery. And Lincoln said in his House Divided address in 1858, as the first step toward putting it in the course of ultimate extinction, the Southern states took that as the handwriting on the wall that if this party ever gained control of the United States government, the institution of slavery would be doomed. So when Lincoln was elected as president in 1860. Lincoln bent over backwards to try to reassure them that he did not have any intentions to interfere with slavery in the states, only to restrict its expansion. But as we've already mentioned, as the war went on, and as the war turned against the Union in 1862, Lincoln began moving in the direction of putting his foot down to convert slavery into a Union asset, convert it away from being a Confederate asset. So Lincoln is already beginning to move to the left.
James, some of the imagery at the time really does depict this act of justice notion within the Republican Party, and the image that we have here really kind of has two sides to it.
It does. It's very clear. And this was something that in 1858, Lincoln chided Stephen A. Douglas for not being able or willing to see that there is a good and a bad side to this question. There is a moral and an immoral position on slavery. And to illustrate it here, in the case of this one of several historical vignettes compiled into a broadside enshrining the Emancipation Proclamation text itself, that's what you see in the middle there, with down the left side of the image all kinds of evil. At the top, there is a devil woman, bare-breasted, looking down upon the scenes of blacks being whipped or in chains or in a neck brace in one case. And then down the right side, there is the angel looking down upon it all, that there are families binding together, that there are people learning to read. And these are the two sides that increasingly were becoming clear as the only two positions that you could really hold by 1862 on the institution of slavery. It was either barbaric and wrong, or that it was something that you wanted to defend and that's what the South was founded to do. Their vice president, Alexander Stevens, said Negro slavery was the cornerstone of the Confederacy.
The Emancipation Proclamation is a wartime act. There was a concern that Lincoln had of what the status of the slaves would be after the war was over. What was the status of the slaves after the war was over, given this fact?
Well, since the justification for the Emancipation Proclamation was as a wartime measure to help the North win the war, taken by Lincoln in his capacity as wartime commander-in-chief, there was a great deal of uncertainty what would happen after the war was over. What about those slaves who had not achieved any kind of freedom under the Emancipation Proclamation? Would they still be slaves? Would the Supreme Court nullify Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation? Would it have any effect at all in peacetime? Lincoln was really concerned about that. And as a consequence, he and his party made the commitment as early as 1863, and especially in 1864, when the Senate actually adopted a 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, and Lincoln ran for re-election in 1864 on a platform that contained a plank calling for the enactment of a 13th Amendment to the Constitution to end slavery forever. Lincoln called that a king's cure for all cavils about the legality of the Emancipation Proclamation. If you amend the Constitution, then it's going to be legally locked up and airtight. The House, which had in the 1862 election had seen Democrats gain seats, didn't have a two-thirds majority of Republicans, and so they refused in 1864 to adopt the 13th Amendment, which requires a two-thirds majority in both houses before it can be sent to the states, where three-quarters of them must then ratify it. But once Lincoln was reelected, he then used all his powers of patronage and persuasion to get the House to adopt the 13th Amendment, even including some Democratic votes on January 31st, 1865. And then it went to the states and was eventually ratified. Lincoln, of course, tragically did not live to see it ratified, but it was well on its way to ratification even before he was assassinated.
And can you see on the screen now the physical evidence of why the Emancipation Proclamation needed to be succeeded by, replaced by, transplanted by something broader and stronger, namely a constitutional amendment, because Kentucky, as a border state, was exempted from the Emancipation Proclamation, didn't want to lose Kentucky to the Confederacy by freeing their slaves. And so slavery and slave sales continued to go on in these places, exempted, through as late as we see here, December 1864, people being sold in Louisville, Kentucky, just over the river from free territory in Indiana. And that was legal. And that is what Mr. Lincoln wanted to end. And, of course, with the help of Congress and then the states, did end shortly afterwards. But who's going to hang on to their slaves in Kentucky much longer than this? Because by December of 1864, the war is going very badly for the Confederacy. Certainly in the West, it's nearly over. And I'm not sure, I don't think we know, where these unfortunate nine people would have gone, would have been sold. But their owner in Louisville knew that he or she wasn't going to be able to keep them much longer. And so this is evidence that the whole debate about whether the Emancipation Proclamation had actually done what it was intended to do, whether it had freed people, is still such a live issue. It was one step toward freeing people. The constitutional amendment would be the next big step. There were, in fact, later steps required in this country to make freedom a live thing for people.
Let's talk a little bit about the image of Lincoln as the great emancipator. James, if you can start us off with the image that we're going to see here.
Well, he was certainly called that by a lot of people at the time. It was very much the feeling that he, as the author of the Emancipation Proclamation, that it is his signature on it, along with William Seward's, that makes him deserving of the credit. There are artworks at the time. We've seen the Francis Carpenter painting that supports this notion. And this idea lasted a very long time afterwards. What you see now is a 1922 broadside for an event in Springfield, Illinois, organized by the NAACP chapter there to commemorate the 60th anniversary of emancipation on September 22nd. So that day, you know, what we think of as legally the preliminary one is really a historic date for holding a big get-together at the state fairgrounds in Springfield. And it is Mr. Lincoln's picture that is at the top and center of that poster, flanked by Booker T. Washington and Frederick Douglass, heroes of the day to a large portion of African Americans. And it's really only within the last generation or two of our lifetime that Lincoln's key role as the mover of emancipation has been questioned more deeply. And there are complicated reasons for that. When you're working with art, it's pretty simple to put one person's face or one person's name up there as the emancipator. The situation, as we know, is more complicated.
The Emancipation Proclamation had an enormous symbolic import, I think, as something that everybody could understand and everybody could refer to. It may not have in and of itself freed the slaves. It was an announcement that the Army of the United States after January 1st, 1863, would become an army of liberation. In that respect, I think it's comparable to the Declaration of Independence in July, signed on July 4th, 1776. It did not immediately make the United States independent. They had to win a war in order to do that. But it announced the purpose of the war was to achieve independence for the United States. The Emancipation Proclamation announced a purpose which would only be accomplished if other things happened, primarily Union victory in the war. And I think that had enormously powerful symbolic as well as substantive import, just as the Declaration of Independence did.
Well, Jim and James, thank you very much for this. Appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Well,
thank you,
glad Ken. To be here. Thank you.
I would like to thank Jim McPherson and James Cornelius for joining me for this discussion about the Emancipation Proclamation, a document that fundamentally changed the character of the American Civil War and remains one of the most well-known documents in U.S. history. On behalf of the Pritzker Military Library and the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, I'm Ken Clark. Thanks for watching.
By the support of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, in partnership with the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.